Welcome to Historically Thinking, a program devoted to all kinds of historical knowledge and to the ways that we achieve it. I'm your host, Al Zambone, of the Department of History at Augustana College. Our website is historicallythinking.org, where you can subscribe, find more information about our guests, links, and related readings. Our email address is mail@historicallythinking.org. We'd love to hear from you.
Hello. Today on Historically Thinking, we're doing something new. We're discussing a book, and not just any book, an award-winning book of 2014, probably the book that more American historians are talking about than any other, Edward E. Baptist, The Half Has Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism. But unlike the other days when we discuss books, my guest today is not Edward E. Baptist, but Robert Elder, Assistant Professor of History at Valparaiso University. Today, Bob and I are going to form a kind of a book club of the air, or of the podcast, or whatever, something like that, in which we are going to go back and forth over this important book and what it tells us about the history of American slavery, or what it doesn't tell us about the history of American slavery. Bob, before we began, you were saying that this book has emerged and sort of landed with a huge bang last year in amidst other sorts of cultural, in a sort of a cultural moment. Could you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, I think most of all, the popularity of Baptist's book has to do with this review in The Economist, which was published and then actually retracted.
Yeah, it was withdrawn.
Yeah, which I think the most famous part, the most famous complaint in that review was the reviewer said that Baptist's book portrayed all blacks as victims and all whites as oppressors or something like that.
Right.
I don't remember the exact language.
It was very tweetable.
Yeah, it was very tweetable, very kind of snarky. And it just provoked this huge discussion. But I actually think, which was great for Baptist's book sales,
I think.
It was fantastic. I think he wrote – no, he didn't write the review. I don't mean that.
Yeah.
Please don't. No. But it was one of those – it really was – it was a publicity sensation.
Oh, yeah.
But it was – we need to get back to that because it also – the reaction to it was interesting in what it tells us about the way people think of slavery too.
But I think that part of the reason that it was such a huge deal and that the review kind of provoked this reaction is that we are in this kind of amazing historical cultural moment where modern Americans are rethinking the relationship of our contemporary scene to slavery. And you see that in, you know, kind of pop culture movies like 12 Years a Slave, which really portrays a very, very difficult to watch, disturbing portrayal of slavery, indirectly in movies like Lincoln, which are dealing with the legacies of the Civil War. You had mentioned off-air Django Unchained, which is I kind of like to think of actually Baptist's book is kind of if you want to see it as kind of the backstory to Django Unchained. That's I think one way.
Yeah.
Thinking.
Or Mandingo Part 3. Wasn't there a Mandingo 2? I think there was. But anyway.
one of my favorites, in a strange way right now, is this book that came out a couple of years ago now by James McBride called The Good Lord Bird.
I haven't read that. Just the back. Yeah.
It's about John Brown, but the most interesting – John Brown's raid. But the most interesting part of the book is actually this ground-level view of slavery through the eyes of this young enslaved boy who's the narrator of the book. And And the book, it won the National Book Award, I think, in 2013. And so all this is going on. And at the same time, of course, you have Ta-Nehisi Coates writing in The Atlantic his article on reparations and a lot of shorter articles about how the history of slavery is still very much relevant today. And Coates was getting just amazing traction with these articles. And then right kind of in the middle of that, I think Baptist's book came out.
Yeah. And now if you look at Amazon, frequently bought together along with The Half Has Never Been Told is Ta-Nehisi Coates, Between the World and Me, his new book, and The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Era of Colorblindness.
So, yeah, exactly. I would put those three together. And you know, the connection between all three of those books is that it links our present kind of a racial situation, really, our present racial situation with the history of slavery and Jim Crow.
Right.
And it's kind of a, you know, all three of those are efforts to get modern Americans, mostly modern white Americans, to see themselves as kind of complicit, I guess, in that history in ways that they hadn't before.
We should probably spend 20 minutes probably at the end talking about moral arguments and history, because this the whole book, the whole subject cries out for that. Which is something I think you'd agree historians we usually avoid.
Yeah.
Baptist certainly has not. I don't know if that's accounts for the popularity of it or not. I'm not certain. But one of the things that I passed on to you as we were looking at this was, I mean, every once in a while, I should say to listeners, in the history world, our elders and betters have it out with each other in journals of scholarly opinion, which are normally, and you might not believe this, but normally they're very boring. but this year, in February 2015 issue of Slavery and Abolition, a journal of slave and post-slave studies, Trevor Bernard, who's I think a notable early American historian, teaches in Australia, really wrote one of the most savage attacks on a book that I've read in a scholarly journal. I don't know if you agree with that, Bob, but it left a mark on me after I read it. The lists of Ed Baptist's are many, and he went through them all. And then Baptist came back with an equally vicious counter-response, and it was like watching a fight on the playground. I could hear the shots of fight, echoing in my ears. It's people like swarm the blacktop to see the gladiatorial combat between the fourth graders. Do you want to start with Baptist? How would you summarize Baptist's argument before I get to Bernard and some of the economic historians who have criticized Baptist? Or start wherever you want.
Well, I think one thing to note is that that review, I mean, Bernard's review was definitely the harshest review I have read in a long time, but the harshest review of Baptist in general. But as you mentioned earlier, I mean, Baptist's book has not been, I guess you would say, not been universally acclaimed by historians, especially by historians of slavery. Although there are, I would note, significant exceptions to that. There have been some people who definitely see his book as a really, really important, groundbreaking study. But what is remarkable is that a lot of these new books on slavery and capitalism, and you put Baptist's book is one of those, Walter Johnson's book, River of Dark Dreams, which preceded mm-hmm. Baptist just barely, maybe by months, if not a year.
Yeah.
It's Sven Beckert's Empire of Cotton. It seems to me like a companion volume to Baptist in many
right.
ways.
And although Baptist's book has kind of been getting some of the harshest criticism, all three of those books have come in for pretty sustained criticism at various points. Although also, Beckert's book won the Bancroft, so it's not criticism is a different a different level, I think. But if I had to summarize Baptist. I would say, his title kind of says it all, in some ways, slavery and the making of American capitalism. But he wants to argue, after reading his book, he doesn't want you to be able to go away and think that slavery had nothing to do with the success of American capitalism or the success of the American nation state. I mean, he wants you to go away, I think, with two fundamental ideas. And the first one, I think, is that slavery was incredibly brutal, exploitative, torture. And the second one is that system of kind of industrial torture, as I think he would characterize it, was integral to the growth of the American economy and American wealth even today, and that that the juxtaposing capitalism and slavery against one another is just not something we can do. It's not an accurate depiction of the reality.
Right. So, so part of the argument is slaveholders are capitalists, right?
Right. Which this
what,
is the...
what? No, explain to listeners why that used to be a controversial statement.
Right. Well, I think this partially accounts for some of the harsh reaction, I think, to Baptist's book, is that he doesn't fully acknowledge in the book the extent to which historians have been arguing about this for a century.
Probably since before the Civil War.
Yeah, so the argument about whether or not slavery was a part of capitalism, whether or not slaveholders were capitalists, goes all the way back at least to U.B. Phillips, but before that, it goes. I mean, you can take it all the way back before the Civil War to debates between pro-slavery folks in the South and abolitionists in the North.
Yeah, I've just been reading George Fitzhugh's reviews in the DuBose Review,
right,
just for a separate project. But of course, this is what Jean Genovese shined a bright light on. This is the stuff that made the communists, this is made Herbert Optaker, made other people very excited. These critiques of capitalism that were coming from outside the Marxist movement.
Yes, exactly. And so this is what historians like Eugene Genovese found really exciting about.
Yeah.
The history of the antebellum South is that they saw people, as they argued, as Genovese argued, people critiquing capitalism from outside the system in an era when you wouldn't have expected that, and from a quarter that you wouldn't have expected. And so, that argument between kind of pro-slavery Southerners, white Southerners, and abolitionists about whether or not slavery was capitalistic, how well slaves were treated, you can carry that all the way through to the modern day. And Baptists' argument is that historians, by and large, have simply accepted that slavery wasn't capitalistic, that it was this pre-modern, paternalistic, relatively benign form of labor. And he kind of says that, nobody ever challenged that until me.
Yeah, which is either naive or just I don't know, crazy.
Well, I think it actually goes to the heart of another issue with Baptist book that I think is, I understand a kind of dilemma, I think, that he's caught in, which is that, you know, this is published with Basic Books, which is a great press that tries to publish academic books that reach a broad audience. And I think what you see Baptists doing is portraying the kind of history of the argument in such a way that it will be kind of exciting to read his book for people that that don't know the historiography. So people reading the book have this idea that I'm reading this brand new interpretation of something that nobody has ever said before, which to a professional historian is kind of ridiculous.
Yeah.
But I think that Baptist had to make some decisions. I think it must have been a conscious decision not to get down in the weeds of the historiography. I think he probably went a little bit too far in one direction, but I do think...
Yeah, I understand that, and God knows there are lots of journalists or excellent writers who often write... this story has never been told before.
Right.
I'm thinking of, and yet, well, it has. You've cribbed all the facts from a monograph written in the 60s, but they just write it a hell of a lot more entertainingly than the person who wrote the monograph. That's always irritating when journalists do it. It's especially irritating when a tenured professor at Cornell does it. I think that he has it. I think there are alternatives. You know, I think that he could have had an appendix, for example.
Mm-hmm.
He says, well, in his response to Bernard, this is not the sort of book in which you write a first chapter with a historiographical discussion. Well, no, and those are boring. Yep. But you could have put in something else so that, and you could just not have been quite so hyperbolic. The thing that gives him, especially about this subject, if this was about, say, pirates or Chicago gangsters, well, okay, that'd be one thing. But what it gives him is a sort of unique moral credibility.
Mm-hmm.
It gives him a prophetic stance. He is a Jeremiah come to explain to the United States our unique sins, which no one before has ever had the courage to lay out. This subject gives him a moral authority in a way the subject gives him moral authority that otherwise he wouldn't have. Do you see what I mean by that?
Yeah, I do think that's the... that's the rub with this book, is that it's kind of trying to be two books in one. I mean, it was sold before it came out among academics. It was very highly anticipated because it was being described as a new academic interpretation of slavery.
Right.
And on the other hand, outside of academic circles, it's being touted as exactly what you just described, this kind of prophetic tome that connects, American history with slavery. And I think
Go ahead.
Well, I think the rub is that you can't actually do, you can't actually do both things. That the reason some professional historians are annoyed by it is because of that kind of righteous tone that Baptist has, which could be totally appropriate as he faces the public, who really might not have any idea about this history, but which, as he faces the professional academic trade, feels like we're getting lectured to by, a schoolmaster or something like that.
Yeah, I guess that's part of it. But basically, he's calling everyone before him a bunch of liars who haven't been telling the truth.
Right.
I put it even more stronger than being lectured to.
Yeah, I think that's the issue. And the unfortunate thing is that if he had laid out some of the historiography in the beginning, I think he could actually say how the story that he is telling is different, for instance, than Fogel and Engerman's time on the cross. So Fogel and Engerman, of course, are economists who argue very much against the current of professional historians at the time that I think it's 1974.
74, yeah. And the debates went on. Well, I mean, I was reading some economic historians pointing out we really almost need a history of that whole controversy.
Yeah,
it went on for a decade at least. It's still going on.
It was hugely controversial because they argue not only is slavery, they argue slavery is capitalism. It's actually a fairly efficient version of capitalism.
It was not irrational, therefore.
Yeah, it's not irrational. Yeah. It's not paternalistic in the way that U.B. Phillips had described it being paternalistic, in the sense that it was inefficient and only continued because of the kind of benevolence of the slave owners.
They even argued rather sort of there. I'm cheating. I've got the book kind of open, the summary from pages 4 to 6 in front of me. They argue actually not only is it actually efficient, it's 35% more efficient than northern family farming.
Right. So that in and of itself was controversial in one sense, and the other sense, by 1974, the other thing that was controversial about it was that they argued that in some cases slaves on southern plantations were actually better off, materially speaking, in terms of quality of life, than some laborers in northern industrial contexts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that was a hugely controversial claim. And that actually, you know, Baptist is the mirror opposite of that argument.
Yes.
So they are different, even though they're both arguing for slavery as a form of capitalism.
Yeah, I would also, some more of their argument, which is important for this, they would say, and I think Baptists would agree, that it was not an economically moribund system prior to the Civil War. There was there's no indication that economic forces were going to bring slavery to an end.
Right.
And nor were slave owners becoming pessimistic about the future of the system, that they were enthusiastic about the system. That I think Baptists would also agree with.
Yeah, I think he would agree with both of those things. I think the main difference between them is not what capitalism looks like and means to Fogel and Engerman versus what capitalism means to Ed Baptist. And I think that's a distinction that most of the new work on slavery and capitalism shares, is that much of it has a very negative view of capitalism in any form.
Right. And
that's part of the point for Baptist, right, is to kind of damn modern capitalism by associating it with slavery.
It seems like it, but we should probably get back to the next sort of chain in his logic.
Yeah.
Which is that, and as he sees it, and once again, this doesn't seem to me, this is something that people have been arguing for at least about 15 years, well, longer, that, in fact, I just quoted Fogel and Engerman saying basically the same thing. There was an increased productivity in cotton picking from 1800 to 1860.
Mm.
In fact, if I've got the numbers right, it was... it's in Alan Olmsted and Paul Rhodes' article from 2002 that the... And this is really incredible. Labor productivity grew 2.3% a year in cotton from 1800 to 1860. What does Baptist attribute that to?
Well, Baptist number, and I'm sure they probably work out to the same thing. Baptist says that from 1800 to 1860, productivity in terms of yield on cotton plantations goes up by 400%. Which is an absolutely incredible number. And he points out that this matches the gains, for instance, in Northern and European textile mills, that they achieve gains in productivity that are more or less the same, about somewhere around 400%, but that those gains come through mainly technological advancements, more advanced machinery, and those sorts of things. The gains in productivity in cotton production, he argues, come from basically a very refined system of combination of measurement and what he calls, at first he calls negative incentives, and then he says, you know, let's just be honest and call it torture. So he says that the what you see, and it's important to note that here he's talking mainly about the same area of the South that Walter Johnson was talking about, the Mississippi River Valley. He actually argues that you know, the slavery that exists there is different in character and nature than what exists on the Eastern Seaboard.
Which again is an old argument. I just want to point that out. One of the things I say when I introduce slavery into a freshman class in U.S. History 1 is to realize there is not American slavery.
Right.
There are American slaveries, and they change often from state to state depending on the law or how the law is enforced, and from region to region of a state or of a broader, you know, meta region. Anyway, so that's...
Yeah, and the, you know, of course, the most famous distinction is between the caste system that exists in parts of, for instance, the Lowcountry, South Carolina, on rice plantations, where slaves have a set kind of amount of work they have to do, and after they get that, if they get it done in a certain, you know, it doesn't matter how much time they take or don't take to do it, they're done after that. And as opposed to the gang system that exists on most Western plantations, where it is a kind of dawn to dusk sort of thing, yeah, with an overseer and those sorts of things. So Baptist is talking about that second, he calls it a second slavery. And he basically argues that this is where you really see the gains coming from, that you can chart through looking at these plantation record books, where they would keep the amounts of cotton per slave that were picked. And over the course of the first half of the century, you just see those climb and climb and climb as they continually kind of push the bar higher. Slaves would go out every day with you know, their bag, and they would pick as much cotton as they could. They would come back at the end of the day, and each individual slave would have their own quota number, and their bag would get weighed. And if they had come up to the quota, they were fine. And if they hadn't come up to the quota, they would be punished. There was some sort of punishment, often physical punishment, that went along with that. And so over the course of the century, Baptist says there's just a ratcheting up of that system, and that's where the incredible gains come from, not from technological advancement or anything like that.
It's a really interesting question of evidence, and I want to be convinced on one level that they can do this in an evidentiary wise, because this seems to be crucial. Can he show that torture, let's call it torture, and I'm fine with that, torture as a means to increase production, that it rises with severity and sort of insidiousness over time? Are the torturers getting more brutal and more clever in their brutality between 1820 and 1860?
I don't know that he argues that they are getting more brutal over time. I think he argues that it starts out brutal and continues to be. I think what he argues is that, you know, the kind of bar gradually over time gets raised and expectations get raised, and what accounts for the rise in productivity is that slaves are forced to respond in really imaginative flexible ways to this until they become kind of cotton-picking machines, I mean, for lack of a better word. So what's somewhat new about what he's saying is that you know, ingenuity and resistance don't matter in this system. They actually are co-opted into the rising cotton levels. The smarter you were, the harder you worked, the smarter you were, if you could figure out how to pick more cotton, all that meant was that you were going to have a higher quota eventually. And if you slowed down and resisted somehow, all that meant was you were going to get punished. Now, that ignores it. On the one hand, it's a kind of compelling and horrific depiction of slavery that it is in many ways accurate. And on the other hand, it ignores so much of the testimony that we have from frustrated overseers and masters who were saying, look, we just, you know, they are figuring out ways to not do this.
Right.
The kind of weapons of the weak argument, the resistance, I think that was there. It was real. We have too much testimony about that.
Yeah, we do, and we do have too much testimony to that. Now, I don't know, since I'm an Easterner in my focus, and you're a South Carolinian in your focus, I don't know enough about Mississippi River Valley to say whether those testimonies of resistance that I find, I mean, and I'm also a colonialist, I find these testimonies of resistance in colonial documents, right? Even the hiding out for a couple of days, essentially a labor strike, you find that very, very early on. But I don't know about the Mississippi Valley, so I'm tempted to believe what I read.
I think you find it. I'm not a specialist in that region specifically, but you find some of the same patterns there that you would find elsewhere. I think what some historians would say is that it's simply harder to put some of those tactics into practice in the environment of these huge cotton plantations that were run according to these kind of quasi-industrial techniques. It is harder. And slaves know this as well. I mean, slaves, and Baptist actually does a great job of bringing this out, that slaves themselves, another thing that we already knew, but Baptist brings out with very, with a kind of illustrative power, is that slaves were terrified of being sent to Mississippi and Alabama and Louisiana because they knew this. I mean, they knew that slavery was different there than it was on the Eastern Seaboard. So that part of it, I think, is important. If not,
I get no, but it's important, and he writes occasionally evocatively. Some might say, well, Trevor Berner does. He does overwrite in some places, and that's true. But that's I fault his editors more than him for that.
Yeah.
They should just not let him do certain things. That's what editing's for. One, I should say that he does take his numbers on cotton increase in cotton output, which is, you're right, it's over 400%. It's crazy. It's in fact, one comparison I've seen is that the mechanical reaper increased the 50 to 100 increased the productivity of wheat harvest only 50 to 100%.
Yeah.
And here's the output of cotton going up over 400%. The Olmsted and Road argument was breeding of new cotton plants. That we went from short staple cotton in 1800 to which is about an inch in length, the the length of the fiber to a 2-inch length by 1860. And that accounts for the absolutely phenomenal increase in cotton output.
Yeah, that is one argument for the increased output. Another argument is that even within that second type of cotton, there were other different types of seeds that started being used, I believe around Louisiana, but that then started being employed in and around the Mississippi River Valley. And that before was a very kind of persuasive interpretation. Now, Baptist is conscious of those arguments. He claims that he has adjusted even for that, and that they don't account for the kind of gains that he's talking about. I am not enough of a specialist to get down in the weeds on cotton agriculture, but it boggles the mind to me that 400% increase can come only from the methods of kind of torture that Baptist is talking about. Not that couldn't contribute to it, but it just seems that it's more complex. There has to be more to that explanation. It seems different types of oil and seeds have to be part of that equation.
Yeah, beware only one explanation. There has to be a multi-causal explanation for it. I'm sure that torture, that the new growing region, and also that the new breeding of new cotton plants must have all been part of it.
Yep.
And there's probably something else that we haven't thought about yet. He then goes on to say that this increase in cotton production is the driving force behind American growth. And that really, how does he explain that?
Behind the American what? Sorry.
I'm sorry, that the cotton production, that 400% plus increase in cotton production, is the driving force behind American economic growth in the antebellum years.
Yeah. Well, in one sense, this is what most of the new history is arguing. And I actually think this is the most, in some ways, it's the least exciting part of his argument, because it is the most one that everybody now is kind of acknowledging, that cotton is the fuel of the Industrial Revolution in the North and in Europe, that without Southern cotton, Northern textile mills would shut down, European textile mills would shut down. The Industrial Revolution kind of runs on cotton. And this is, you know, Sven Beckert's interpretation, and other people even before Beckert were saying this. So I think that part of what Baptist is saying is actually not that controversial. He may overstate the extent to which cotton was the driving economic force, but certainly when you look at export numbers and the value of cotton in terms of the gross domestic product and things like that, it's a significant force. I mean, it's not for nothing that Southerners are so confident on the eve of the Civil War that they will be able to bring Europe into the conflict, because they think, you know, once we cut off the supply of cotton, they have to come in because they're so dependent on it.
Right. The problem for me is with that, and that's true, that they did think that. However, that was a very erroneous on their part.
Yeah, right.
It turned out they didn't. They, I'm afraid, their understanding of economics was as good as Ed Baptist's, and probably my own. Don't get me wrong. I have the feeling that I'm out of my depth here, and I think he is too. But I'm not. I think I realize, and he doesn't. But the cotton exports are only 4% of the GDP.
Right.
I mean, and that's, you know, okay, you don't want to lose 4% of your GDP, but it's only 4% of the GDP. That seems to me important to realize.
Well, I think that I would have to look at the exact at the exact numbers, but and of course exports are a very, very different thing than just the GDP. So if you look at the GDP, cotton is not as huge a part of that as Baptist maybe seems to say. But if you look at exports, I mean, cotton makes something like half or more of the exports of the U.S. by the 1850s. And so the Southerners' confidence in it is somewhat justified in terms of foreign trade. But yeah, within the U.S., there's a lot of other things going on. But Baptist's point is also not that it's only cotton. I mean, his other point is that it's the actual slave trade itself that is part of the economic activity that everybody kind of wanted in on. So banks in the North and in Europe are, giving Southern slaveholders mortgages basically on their slaves and making money off this in much the way that that people did with subprime mortgages in the 2008 financial crisis, And so these other institutions far outside of the South are tied economically to the interests of slavery. And he starts off the book with this a pretty long section on the Yazoo land speculation bubble crisis in the late 18th century. And his point there is showing that, the Yazoo land, which is kind of in below Tennessee, part of modern-day Alabama, that when people started selling bonds to that, there were people from the North buying these bonds, even though they knew that this land was going to be open to slavery and dependent on slavery and things like that. And so it kind of tied the North to slavery and to the interests of slavery in a really direct way.
Well, there's no denying that, and it's a perfectly legitimate point to make. I'm leery about this is very much like the argument early American history over sugar and the growth of the first British Industrial Revolution.
Right.
Social historians are much more enamored. I mean, enamored of the Eric Williams book, which the Prime Minister of Trinidad, wasn't he? As well as a historian on the idea that sugar grew the Industrial Revolution. And God, if literary historians didn't know that, then I don't know how they would ever interpret Mansfield Park. The problem is that I think economic historians have shown that your money would have been better invested if you had bought British consols or just bonds than putting your money into sugar. There was the sort of basic internal finance mechanisms like treasury bonds were a lot more productive and a lot more beneficial to English investors than investing in sugar. So I've actually had to change my mind a lot about that in the last 5 years. As I've done more reading outside my, outside intellectual and social, as I started to read economic history.
Well, I think sugar is actually a great example because, Baptist kind of, he says that the slavery that exists in the Mississippi River Valley, this second slavery is, and I'm not exactly sure how to, I'm not exactly sure I'm reading him right here, but I think what he's arguing is that form of slavery is capitalism. And what came before it was somehow not quite capitalism or something.
Yeah, I don't buy that for a second. There's certainly a profit and loss and future, all that's going through Caribbean planners' heads too.
Yeah, exactly. So what it ignores is the broader history of sugar, especially where sugar plantations are being run. I mean, you talk about a capital investment. Sugar was hugely more of a capital investment. I mean, it took much more capital to start a sugar plantation because of the equipment than it did to grow cotton. And sugar plantations as a mass plantation experiment certainly preceded Cotton. So I, you know, in terms of saying that this was new, I don't quite buy that. And I also, I should say, don't quite buy the argument, or I don't think the argument is distinct enough to say this was capitalism. And, you know, that it's the same thing as a wage laborer in the, you know, in a textile mill in the North. There are too many significant differences between the two, that I think Baptist, he wouldn't deny the differences, I think, but I think he would say they're part of the same system. Which I think is true, but the difference with slavery, and this is what people like Genovese were always arguing and getting at, the difference with slavery is that you don't have that complete abstraction of wage labor. That in terms of a, if you want to call it a strict Marxist interpretation of capitalism, you know, what capitalism really in the end requires is the abstraction of labor to the point where you can put a number on it by the hour and pay for it that way and not have to deal with the human beings at all. Right. And in that sense, even with slavery, even if you're buying someone's labor, as some pro-slavery theorists would say, you're only buying a lifetime of labor when you buy a slave, you know. You don't actually buy the person. That's an argument that some of them would make. The complicating factor with slavery was that you got the person along with the labor.
Whether you wanted them or not.
Yeah, and that I really think that made a difference, and for me introduces a whole different dynamic into the economic system of slavery than you find in, you know, in wage labor. It just complicates everything immensely, and it makes me swing back a little more toward Eugene Genovese's famous kind of line there in Roll, Jordan, Roll, where he says, you know, that this system of slavery was brutal, it was exploitative, but at the same time it tied these two people together, blacks and whites together, in this system where they came to inhabit a common culture where neither one of them could think about the most basic human functions and practices without reference to the other. And I don't think you get that complexity with Baptist. It just loses... It loses some of the, it's too simple. It's too, not that it, you know, the brutality of it, I totally acknowledge, but the fact that these people also had to live together, I think, is lost somewhat in that.
My guest today has been Bob Elder, assistant professor of history at Valparaiso University. I should say that part of all of this thinking and meditation upon slavery and capitalism is part of Bob's trying to rethink John C. Calhoun and other Southern slavery advocates. So, Bob, one of these years, we can talk about that book. And in the meantime, best of luck to you, and thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
For more historical thinking, go to historicallythinking.org. where you can comment on today's program and find show notes, links, and readings related to today's conversation. Historically Thinking is recorded in the studio of WAUG, the student radio station of Augustana College. Our program's editor is John Ruddat. Beth Leimbach keeps the schedules in sync. Matt Lejas keeps WAUG studio running. I'm your host, Al Zambone. Talk to you next week.